This is Judith Leigh welcoming you to Manx Radio and to the podcast of this week's edition of At Your Service. Manx Radio. I'm sure you don't need me to remind you that this is Mothering Sunday. In the 16th century, it was a day to encourage people to return on the fourth Sunday in Lent to their mother church in order to renew their faith. About 100 years later, the day gave those in service a chance to visit the family home after that church service and take a gift of wayside flowers. And simnel cake was once enjoyed on Mothering Sunday rather than at Easter. Then, the original Christian values of Mothering Sunday were restated by a vicar's daughter, encouraging us to look to Mary, the mother of Jesus, as an inspiration to all who are called to be mothers. It's also a time to treasure memories and give thanks for mothers and mother figures who are gone but will never be forgotten. The three Heap brothers celebrate their mother with words that will, I think, touch both children and mothers today.
I gave you heartburn and I made you sick long before I even took my first breath. And you barely slept for 2 years after you brought me home. I ruined your carpet and colored your walls, then did it again after you scrubbed it off. And if you were lucky, I'd give you the bathroom alone. But still you look back on it all and you smile. So here's to you, Mom, from the heart of your child. Thank you for loving me tenderly and showing me how to be strong. Least I can do after all you have done is thank you for being my mom. I thank you for being my mom. For listening to me when that girl stole my heart and letting me practice with your brand new car. For teaching me how to make Jesus my every. Right there every time that I fall, and praying for me faithfully through it all. I am convinced I'm still here 'cause you stayed on your knees. I don't tell you enough just how special you are, but I'm grateful, so know from the depths of my heart. Loving me tenderly and showing me how to be strong. The least I can do after all you have done is thank you for being my mom. I thank you for being my mom. Someday I'll be the one with blue marks on my walls and staying awake all night long. As hard as I try, I can honestly say that we all would be lost without mom. So thank you for loving me tenderly and showing me how to be strong. The least I can do after all you have done is thank you for being my mom. I thank you for being my mom.
Celebrating Mothering Sunday with music from the three Heap brothers. And now it's time to meet today's special guest. Her fascinating story begins about 50 years ago, but has fueled her passion for the work that she does today, which is being the founder of the charity called Together for the Common Good. But what is the common good, and why is it so important? The person who can provide all the answers joins me now. She is Jenny Sinclair, the daughter of Bishop David and Grace Shepherd, Bishop David Shepherd being the Anglican Bishop of Liverpool from 1975 until his retirement in 1997. Jenny, good morning and welcome.
Morning, and thank you for having me. It's lovely to be here.
I would like to take us back now to the 1970s. And your father, Bishop David Shepherd, was the Anglican Bishop of Liverpool at the same time as Archbishop Derek Warlock was the head of the Roman Catholic Church in Liverpool. They were famed for their partnership that responded to a Liverpool, a Merseyside, that was in a desperate state at that time, a state of unrest and despondency and despair. And they saw what was needed and almost instinctively reached out. Take us back to those days, Jenny, would you, and share what you recall of it, please?
So I was 13 when we moved up, and that was 1975. And Derek was appointed Archbishop of Liverpool 6 months after we arrived. So my father knew who was coming, and on the night that he knew Derek was arriving, he went round to his house with a bottle of wine and rang the doorbell and introduced himself. And it's important to say that neither of them had really been ecumenical before this time. There wasn't a track record of working across differences before. But I think they both knew, for different reasons, that they had been called there around the same time. And this was the action of the Holy Spirit in their lives. So Derek told me, just before he died, that Pope Paul VI had given him a double mandate for that job. He said, "I want you to stop Liverpool becoming a second Belfast, and to work with the poor and unemployed." And he'd been down south in Portsmouth. So he came with those specific intentions. My father had been in London. Having been originally a conservative evangelical back in the 50s, he had shifted to becoming quite influenced by what we call the social gospel, which is a church that's interested in social issues. So he'd already become quite political by that stage. He was the chair of the Martin Luther King Foundation. He'd been a leading campaigner in the anti-apartheid movement, for example. So when he came to Liverpool, he was very attuned to the unemployment, which was very severe. There was what they call capital flight. You know, there was withdrawal of investment around that time. In years later, we discovered from when the Thatcher papers were released that the government was actually pursuing a policy of managed decline for the city, but nobody knew that at the time. So at the time we arrived, 1975, the local political leadership, local government, was very dysfunctional. And there was a kind of vacuum of leadership. And I think the bishops, they kind of became default community leaders. And they decided right from the beginning to work together. And they felt called by God as brothers in Christ. That's how they described it. They spoke on the phone every day for 22 years. They never broke any rules in terms of doctrine. They never took communion together. This is not allowed in terms of the Catholic rules. And they felt the pain of separation. That's the way they described it. But they were absolutely devoted to this partnership. And they did many things in public together. And they were warned, actually, by some who were very worried about the sectarian undertones of the city. Some people at the beginning said, "Don't touch this, it's too dangerous. It's like lifting the lid off Pandora's box, leave it alone." But they decided together deliberately to ignore this and to be very explicit and upfront about their what they would call a civic friendship across difference. And as this partnership between him and my father really settled and grew, and this is through the late 70s now, coming up to sort of 1980, 1981, and there were riots and so on. There was very, very serious stuff going on in Liverpool and across the country, social unrest. Their partnership turned out to be, you know, really significant for the city, standing alongside poor communities, negotiating between, say, the police and the black community, between business and unions, and across the divide, across the sectarian divide. And as they pursued this partnership, the sectarian divide kind of healed.
"Make me a tunnel of your peace. Where there is hatred, let me bring your love. Where there is injury, your pardon, Lord.
In the 1960s, young priest Derek Warlock had spent several years working in Rome. It was the Second Vatican Council, a time of great change in the Roman Catholic Church, and it was there that Derek Warlock met another young priest, a Polish priest called Karol Wojtyla. As they became firm friends, neither could have imagined that Polish priest would one day become Pope John Paul II. Jenny Sinclair takes up the story again.
Derek wrote to his friend, John Paul II, and he said, "You must come and see what's happening. Will you come?" And of course, no pope, no reigning pope had been in England since the Reformation. This is a very big request. And Pope John Paul wrote back and said, "I will come." So this was a very big deal. But of course, the Falklands War was going on at the time, which made it very difficult diplomatically for this to happen. It would have made it look as if the pope was siding with Britain. And so that's why it was a pastoral visit, not a state visit. And Derek negotiated all of that with the South American bishops and with the Vatican and with the Foreign Office. And as a result of that, you have Pope John Paul II and Robert Runcie, the Archbishop of Canterbury at the time, kneeling before the tomb of Edward the Confessor, praying together. And this is an absolutely iconic moment. As I say, nothing like that happened for 500 years. Now we think it's just normal for Pope Francis and Archbishop Welby to do things together, but it didn't happen before then. They did many things together for the city, like they helped to start Liverpool Hope University. They were instrumental in bringing three teacher training colleges together to save them, and they steered that through to start that university. They set up the Liverpool 8 Law Centre. When the city went through deep tragedy, like the Hillsborough disaster, for example, in 1989, it's like the whole city wanted to mourn, and they held big public requiem mass, for example, in the Metropolitan Cathedral the day after the disaster. They both spoke at Anfield. It's a strange thing nowadays. We're in this very secular environment now. They were actually held in great affection by the people, even people who didn't go to church. They were like, "Oh yes, those guys, they were on our side."
I recognise everything that you said as somebody who lived through all of that. I think we need to also mention that the moderator, John Newton, was also a part of this partnership. Although it was your father and it was Archbishop Derek who were the very visible partnership, he was always there and he was always giving his 100% support to it.
He was, and they really valued his role in it. In fact, the press were terrible. The press used to crop him off photographs, and so they deliberately put him in the middle of them so he couldn't be cropped out. But he was a wise man, and he was a great friend of theirs, and he was involved for quite a number of years. But there were other church leaders as well. There was Salvation Army, there were Baptists, there were other denominations as well.
It was a truly ecumenical effort.
Yeah. And actually, as a result of what they did, it enlivened the sort of Churches Together movement across the country. So there was a sort of what they used to call an ecumenical sort of heyday in the mid-80s. You know, it waned later, but they were part of that.
I think the memorial that was unveiled halfway down Hope Street, which is a pair of doors says it all. They pushed open every door that they came to. They did everything that they could to open it. And that's a wonderful legacy. Mm-hmm. Jenny, I'd like to talk about you now. Mm-hmm. Now, I would feel that growing up in what could only be described as a high-profile family, did you feel that it put excessive pressures on you as you were growing through your teenage years and into young adulthood?
I was a rebel. I was not a happy child and not a happy clergyman's daughter. I was an only child, and we lived in this ridiculously big house with 8 bedrooms, and I really didn't like it. It was a public building, so I didn't feel I had any privacy. I used to come home from school and there'd be some vicar or someone in the family room, and I'd be resentful that I have to share the space with him. I wasn't happy at all. I became estranged from the church when I was around 14 and couldn't wait to leave home, left home at 18, wasn't practicing as a Christian, and I was sort of rather lost like that for some years. My parents were very worried about me. I was a real headache, that's the truth. And it was then much later, when I was 25, that I had a conversion experience, much to my surprise and everybody else's. I was called into the Catholic Church and I converted. I became Catholic at 26.
How did it happen? Was it somebody you met? Was there some crossroads that you reached? What brought about the change?
So, it was through meeting the man who'd become my husband, and he was a cradle Catholic from Glasgow. And he said, "Do you want to come to Mass?" just casually one day. And so I thought, OK, I've never done that before. But it wasn't a big deal. It was a sort of routine thing. He wasn't a sort of very serious Catholic. And so I started going to Mass every week in January 88. And at that time, the liturgy was exactly the same as the Anglican, because the translation hadn't changed at that point. So I had this very discombobulating experience of knowing every word and yet feeling I was on a different planet. So I was like, what's going on? Why does this feel so different? And it must have just gently worked on me. But then 3 months later, I had what you would call a dark night of the soul, you know, a very frightening experience, and found myself sort of seeing the whole of my life pass before me. And I felt I was praying to save my life. And by the time the night was over, I knew that I was being called to a relationship with God, and it was real. So I was quite scared by it, but I knew it was real. And he introduced me to his priest, who was a priest in London, Michael Hollings. And Michael was really responsible for bringing me in. And in fact, I found out later, Michael was well known as a priest for managing difficult conversions. And I was probably a difficult conversion. He was very wise. He didn't send me on courses and things like that. He gave me one book to read. He didn't make it too easy for me. He was quite tough with me. I used to go into his office and cry my eyes out and say, "Oh, I'm not worthy." And he said, "Of course you're not worthy, dear. Don't be ridiculous. That's the whole point. None of us are worthy." And he didn't sort of welcome me in an enthusiastic welcome like lots of people think they have to with modern day churches. He held up quite a barrier for me to climb over, and I did, you know, and I was received after 6 months after that experience, but it was probably another 3 or 4 years before it had really taken, as it were, before it had become embedded in my life.
How did your husband feel? Did it remake or strengthen or change his faith?
No, I don't think so. He was at the time just very matter-of-fact about it, which was probably a very good position to have taken. And as time has gone on, you know, my faith has really deepened, and I think probably his has sort of pretty much stayed the same.
So did this conversion experience inspire you to perhaps look back over your life or to look forward to how you might work it out?
No, the answer is no. So I converted when I was 26. After that, I would say it was probably for about the next 22, 23 years, I just lived a quiet life, private prayer life, raised my children. I worked as a graphic designer, nothing special. In fact, I deliberately avoided working in the church because I found my father's shadow really quite difficult to live with. And I needed to plough my own furrow. So it wasn't until I was in my late 40s in 2011. So this is long after my father died. He died in 2005 and my mother died in 2010. In the January of 2011, I was getting a lot of correspondence because I'm the only child, I'm responsible for their legacies and my father's publications and the archive and everything. And after my mother's death, there was a lot of correspondence, not just condolences, but people saying, what's happened to the Shepherd Warlop thing? You know, the church needs people like them now. And I was getting these letters thinking, it's nothing to do with me. You know, they wrote a book together. They have a track record. But it started to sort of nag at me. And looking back on it now, I didn't realise it exactly at the time. It was the beginnings of the Holy Spirit nudging me. And what happened was I felt compelled to look at their partnership. And I started by having conversations with people who had worked with them. So they, everyone from Frank Field, Clifford Longley, various bishops, people in social action, all sorts. And I followed a trail across a year. One person led to another. Oh, you should meet so-and-so, you should meet so-and-so. And I was beginning to be curious, what was it about their partnership that made it so resonant? Why were the city so affectionate about them? Because even years and years later, getting a taxi, and if it came up in conversation, people would be very positive in a way that they weren't normally positive about the church. So I became very interested in the role of the church in society, its sort of civic role. And by the end of that year, I think I'd spoken to about 100 people, and someone said to me, you probably ought to start a steering group or something, because it's got legs, you know, this thing you're doing. And I still didn't really know what I was doing, but I did start a steering group in 2012. And then we had our first conference in 2013. We set up a website, we started a newsletter, started holding events, we published a book, and things started to take off from there. And at the very beginning, this initiative was simply to look at the Shepherd Warlock Partnership, to see what was relevant for now, to publish a book and go home. And it was meant to be a one-off project. But after our first conference, we attracted so much interest and there was so much energy around it. People were saying, what are you going to do next? We realised that we were on to something else.
And my special guest today, Jenny Sinclair, was indeed on to something else. Something she believes is so important that it has been her vocation for the last 13 years. Jenny returns to the programme next week to complete the story and to lay down a challenge. But if you can't wait to know more, take a look at her website, togetherforthecommongood.co.uk. Now it's time to take a look at our notice board, and we start with services today. There's an extra special Mariners service tonight as the Mariners celebrate their 50th anniversary. Anyone with any connection to the Mariners over the years is invited to come and join in what promises to be a wonderful celebration. Reverend Chris Belfield will preach, and the service in Peel Methodist Church, where the very first Mariners service was held, is at 6:30 tonight and will, as usual, be followed by supper and community hymn singing. And in other news, on Tuesday the 12th, there's a coffee morning in Ballyfesson Methodist Chapel in Port Erin. The kettle's on from 10 till 11:30. And on Tuesday evening, there's a public meeting at 7 o'clock in the Manx Museum Lecture Theatre, hosted by Manx Duty of Care, with guest speakers Alex Schadenberg of the Euthanasia Prevention Coalition in Canada and Duncan Gerry, consultant in elderly care medicine at Nobles Hospital. The evening is free, open to all, and will include a question and answer session. The season of spring concerts in St Catherine's Church in Port Erin start this Thursday, that's the 14th, when Russian Silver Band will give a concert starting at 7:45, with free admission and a retiring collection. There'll be refreshments afterwards in the hall next to St Catherine's, and a warm welcome for all. On Friday the 15th, there's a quiz night organised by Lonnon Men's Fellowship, starting at 7 o'clock in Baldrine Hall in aid of Baldrine Chapel funds. £7.50 per person, including a buffet supper. Teams of six, please, and booking is essential as numbers are limited. Contact Julie on 433 235 433 235. On Saturday, March the 16th, in Onchan Methodist Church, there's an afternoon concert with the award-winning Londo Male Voice Choir, conducted by Julian Power. The concert starts on Saturday afternoon at 2:30. There's free admission with tea and cakes afterwards. And as a bonus, you'll be going home in the daylight. And we finish off with information for next Sunday the 17th. Next Sunday afternoon in Kirkmichael Methodist Church, there'll be a concert of popular music by the Kirkmichael Chamber Orchestra with organist Gareth Moore. Admission is free with a retiring collection, and the concert next Sunday in Kirkmichael Methodist Church starts at 3 o'clock. Then next Sunday evening, there's another Manx English bilingual service in Ballybeg Methodist Chapel. It'll be led by Reverend Dr. Janet Corlett on the theme In Depth of Sea, celebrating those who go down to the sea in ships. It'll include special solos and will be followed by a Manx tea, with a warm welcome for all. That's Ballybeg next Sunday evening at 6:30. And finally, next Sunday evening, the Mariners Choir will be in Union Mills Methodist Chapel for a service starting at 6:30, when the preacher will be Reverend David Shurtliff. And of course, there'll be refreshments and community hymn singing afterwards. And I'm afraid that's all that we have time for now. But I'll be back later in our virtual lounge tonight from 9 o'clock onwards, with our usual mix of easy listening music, your requests and your dedications. And I really hope you can join me then. So, until whenever we meet again, this is Judith saying thank you for listening, and I wish you and those you love a blessed and peaceful week, and a very good morning.
The Nation Station, Manx Radio.